From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming your way, the World Bank answers a call for help from Ebola-stricken African countries.
As a result of the Ebola, most businesses shut down.
A call for an immediate ceasefire in Yemen and a new push for the use of body cameras by U.S. law enforcement. That and more, all ahead. I'm Ira Melman. The World Bank says it will give three West African countries at least $650 million over the next year to 18 months to help them recover from the devastating effects of the Ebola disease. This new bank pledge brings the organization's total financing for Ebola response and recovery to $1.62 billion. The bank's president, Jim Yong Kim, announced the new funding at a meeting with U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, Ghanaian President Alpha Conde, Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, and Sierra Leonean President Ernest Baikoroma. The three presidents presented their Ebola recovery plans to global development leaders at this meeting. Now, the Sierra Leonean president, Ernest Baikoroma, spoke with VOA's Africa Service about the economic effect the Ebola outbreak has had in his country.
As a result of the Ebola, most businesses shut down. A good number of the mining companies ceased operations. Flights were canceled to the country. Tourism was almost brought to a standstill. And even within the country, businesses that we are operating scaled down substantially. So there was a considerable slowdown in the economy, loss of revenue to government, loss of revenue to individuals, loss of revenue to institutions and businesses. And the country was more or less isolated.
The bank estimates the Ebola epidemic has crippled the economies of the three African nations, with GDP losses totaling $240 million for Liberia, $535 million for Guinea, $1.4 billion for Sierra Leone. Joining us now in the studio is VOA economics correspondent Jim Randall. Jim, is this enough to make any kind of dent whatsoever in the battle against Ebola?
I think so. I think right now the focus is on getting the last cases. The bumpy road to getting zero cases is the mantra. And they've clearly been able to make some progress because it's gone from a crisis to a problem. And they've made enormous progress, many fewer cases. And these are relatively small countries, so $1 billion is a big deal. However, in discussion with Ban Ki-moon and with World Bank President Jim Yong Kim, the figure $8 billion came up as what it will take to fully recover. And by that they mean to establish an effective public health system, roads and so people can get around and restore confidence in the economy, those kinds of things. It's going to be a long road.
That obviously opens the door for more money coming from the World Bank, and I guess that just leaves that wide open for more money that's needed when it's needed.
Well, sure. And there are a variety of organizations meeting with the World Bank, and there's a donors conference in July, I think, in New York. The UN is organizing more money. Many aid organizations from many nations were attending this meeting, and they were talking about digging up more money because that will clearly help.
The Ebola crisis has just about dropped out of the headlines in many places around the world, including here in the United States. Has this led to the situation that's faced now with less money coming in?
I don't know. I do think that Jim Yong Kim is sounding the alarm. He said as long as there's one case of Ebola, and there's a lot more than that, as long as there's one case, this deadly, terrible virus is a threat to these countries in West Africa, to the region, and to the world. And so he was pretty blunt about it.
Is this money earmarked for any particular job?
This is the World Bank. It's probably every nickel is spoken for one way or another. The focus is to improve hospitals, to train physicians, to reopen the schools, to get the kind of sewers and clean water and the kinds of things that you need in order to fight another outbreak of this or some other disease, and to just generally prosper, move toward a little bit more functional society.
Was this latest move in reaction to the calls for help from the leaders of these three countries?
It certainly didn't hurt. I mean, these are very... I looked at the three of them today, and they look exhausted. They look very, very, very worn. And no surprise, they've just gone there. All three of these countries have gone through just a terrible, terrible time. And they were speaking slowly and as if they were having a very tough... And I think that their message that they were in dire, dire trouble, and they reached out to the world and asked for help, and they got a lot. It was slow getting started, but thousands of Americans, thousands of people from many other nations, and millions of dollars went to these three relatively small countries to try to help out. And they did some good.
VOA Economics correspondent Jim Randall, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Votes are being counted in Sudan after 4 days of casting ballots in national elections this week, a process troubled by poor turnout and an opposition boycott of the polls. While results aren't expected until later this month, they are expected to include victories for incumbent President Omar al-Bashir and his ruling National Congress Party because of the opposition boycott. The three-day voting period that began Monday was extended into Thursday to make up for poor turnout earlier in the week. The chair of the National Electoral Commission, Mukhtar al-Assam, said President Bashir is likely to win the presidential vote, although if he does not get more than 50%, a second round will be held. He said results from each polling station will be announced as soon as they're available, but the final tally won't be revealed until April 27th. President Bashir, who was wanted by the International Criminal Court on war crimes charges, has been in power since 1989 and won a 2010 vote that the opposition charged was rigged. The European Union, United States, Britain, and Norway all have criticized the election, saying the lack of a promised national dialogue has left Sudan without an inclusive political process. The Democratic Republic of Congo's government has signed up for a new plan to stabilize North Kivu, the DRC province with the worst levels of violence and insecurity. This plan's volunteer says it involves more local consultation than previous plans. For VOA, Nick Long has more from the North Kivu capital of Goma.
The plan is really a continuation of a stabilization and reconstruction program known as STAREC that was launched in 2009 and ran out of funding 3 years later. By then, donors had lost confidence in the program owing to renewed conflict, but also flaws in its design and implementation. The program covered 5 provinces of eastern Congo, and more than $200 million was spent, mainly on building or repairing more than 100 police stations and government buildings, reopening 1,400 kilometers of roads, and training about 1,500 police and officials. STAREC's national coordinator, Alan Kashindi Asumani, told VOA the first phase of the program had limited results because it did not meet the population's real needs.
On s'est attaqué aux conséquences et non aux causes des conflits. Par exemple, au lieu de s'attaquer, par exemple...
STAREC 1 addressed the consequences, but not the causes of conflict, he says. For example, instead of attacking poverty, which is one of the causes of conflict, it concentrated on repairing damage caused by warlords. A spokesman for civil society groups in North Kivu, Gento Maundu, agrees.
Le plus grand problème, c'est que on luttait contre. Le projet, c'était mettre fin, lutter contre la pauvreté.
The biggest problem with the first phase of STAREC, he says, is that it didn't include a strategy for directly attacking poverty, which is the machine producing the armed groups destabilizing eastern Congo. The new strategy for North Kivu and the other provinces is based on consultation with many people in the affected areas. One of the non-governmental organizations carrying out these consultations is International Alert. Maria Lange is International Alert's director in the DRC. She thinks STAREC Phase 1 had several shortcomings.
I have come across projects where a prison was built that didn't have any bars, for example. You know, there were some examples of just really poor project execution. Some things were done well, but I think the lack of engagement by the Congolese government was definitely one of the main problems, as well as a lack of actually asking the communities what they need.
Starek has admitted that some of the police stations and offices that it built have been underutilized, as not enough police or officials were deployed to those places. The new strategy calls for ongoing democratic dialogue to ensure that projects meet people's needs and to make the government more accountable to its citizens. Changing the political culture may be harder to achieve than reducing poverty in some of Kivu's villages, but Lange believes those two aspects of the program have to go together.
There might be less interest by certain parts of government in the whole democratic dialogue aspects of that strategy, but I think that past experience, including Starek Phase 1, demonstrates that it's a very necessary component of development.
The stabilization strategy is just one of several blueprints aimed at achieving lasting peace in eastern Congo. There's also a program to demobilize Congolese armed groups, which the government has been urged to reactivate, and a peace and security agreement which the DRC signed with neighboring countries, including Rwanda and Uganda. International Alert is calling for the dialogue around Starek Phase 2 not to ignore those countries.
It should evidently include neighbouring countries as well that are also signatories to that, and I think we haven't seen very much progress on that front so far.
The DRC government, the United Nations and donors have been talking about the second phase of Starek for 3 years, and it sounds as if there is a lot more talking still to come. Nick Long for VOA News, Goma.
The United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is calling for an immediate end to fighting in Yemen, where a Sunni Arab-led coalition is conducting airstrikes against Shiite rebels. In a speech Thursday in Washington, Mr. Ban warned Yemen was in flames, and he said the only resolution was for all sides to stop hostilities and to take part in negotiations.
Even before the latest escalations, two out of three Yemenis relied on humanitarian assistance. Levels of food insecurity were higher than in the poorest stretches of Africa. The recent fighting has only multiplied the sufferings and insecurity. Hundreds are dead. Humanitarian supplies are being blocked. And UNICEF has reported that an astounding of one-third of the fighters are children. That is why I'm calling for an immediate ceasefire in Yemen by all the parties. It is time to support corridors of life-saving aid and a passage to real peace.
Mr. Ban told the National Press Club in Washington that the United Nations-supported diplomatic process remains the best way out of a drawn-out war with terrifying implications for regional stability. At least 700 people have died since the Saudi Arabia-led coalition began airstrikes 3 weeks ago against the Houthi rebels who were believed to be backed by Iran. The UN on Friday sent out an urgent appeal for $274 million to help provide emergency assistance to the millions affected by the conflict, noting that at least 150,000 have been displaced by the violence. From Washington, this is International Edition from the Voice of America. Pope Francis is considering adding a stop in Cuba to his U.S. trip in September, but no decision has been made, according to the Vatican. Francis has been credited with having helped the U.S. and Cuba reach their historic rapprochement by writing to the leaders of both countries and having the Vatican host their delegations for the final negotiations. The Vatican spokesman, the Reverend Federico Lombardi, said Francis is considering the idea of a Cuba leg, but that discussions with Cuba are at an early stage. Said it's too early to say that a decision has been taken or that there is an operational plan underway. The possibility of a Cuban stop was first reported by the Wall Street Journal. Francis is scheduled to visit three U.S. cities in the last week of September. He'll address Congress and meet with President Obama at the White House, address the United Nations in New York, and attend a church rally for families in Philadelphia. If a Cuba stop is confirmed on either end of the U.S. trip, Francis would become the third pope to visit the island nation after the historic 1998 visit of St. John Paul II, during which he said Cuba should open itself to the world, and may the world open itself up to Cuba. The recent shooting of an unarmed black man by a white police officer in South Carolina has prompted new calls for the use of body cameras by U.S. law enforcement. U.S. Congressman Emanuel Cleaver is sponsoring legislation in Congress to make this a reality. In a recent interview with hashtag VOA, Cleaver said his bill has wide support in both chambers of Congress. VOA's Doug Bernard has more.
Walter Scott was shot 8 times in the back while fleeing from a police officer. The officer claimed self-defense. Video shot by a bystander was pivotal in filing murder charges against Officer Michael Slager. The police officer is white. The victim is black.
Yeah, I do
U.S. Congressman Emanuel Cleaver.
I was sick in the stomach, as I have been over a number of shootings of unarmed African-American men in the past few years.
The shooting reignited tensions over race and policing. It comes just months after Michael Brown of Ferguson, Missouri, was shot and killed by a white police officer. The White House seized on the South Carolina case to make a pitch for wider use of body cameras.
There's also some academic evidence to indicate that the use of body cameras actually is correlated closely with a pretty significant decline in the number of violent incidents that police officers who are wearing body cameras are less likely to get involved in a violent confrontation when they're wearing those cameras.
Congressman Cleaver agrees and has introduced legislation to provide cash grants to U.S. law enforcement to buy the equipment.
To figure out how impactful this would be, everybody who is watching us chat now will confirm, if not in public, in private, that if they had a camera on their lapel with a voice component, it would change their entire life. I mean, nobody, wants to have everything they say and do on camera. And if you're going to do something really bad, you really don't want your comrades to see you in a situation where you are violating every rule of law enforcement by disrespecting and, in some cases, actually hurting a citizen that you were sworn in to protect.
Steve Tuttle is with Taser, one of the country's largest suppliers of body cameras. He spoke to VOA via Skype.
The good news about the body cameras that we make, they're from the officer's perspective. That's the POV, point of view. It is going to miss certain things. They're not magic bullets. It's not a panacea to all of our problems here. But when it comes to recording the best available evidence, clearly, if we had in Ferguson video, audio, we might have less doubt and uncertainty.
Congressman Cleaver sees body cameras as only part of the solution. He wants to see a wider discussion between law enforcement and their communities and invites people to join that conversation on social media.
Let's talk. Hashtag let's talk, because I do think that's good. We need to talk.
Doug Bernard, VOA News.
Syrian President Bashar Assad is blaming Turkey for the fall last month of Syria's northwestern city of Idlib to Islamic fighters, saying Ankara provided huge support, logistic and military, that played the key role in the defeat of his forces. Idlib's fall was a major blow to Assad's government. The city was captured by opposition fighters led by al-Qaeda's branch in Syria, the Nusra Front, and the ultra-conservative Ahrar al-Sham group. It was the second provincial capital to fall to militants during Syria's civil war. The city of Raqqa fell in 2013 and is now in the hands of the Islamic State militants. In remarks published Friday in a Swedish newspaper, the Syrian president said the main factor was the huge support that came through Turkey, logistics support and military support. The Syrian army has lost several areas recently to opposition fighters, including a border crossing point with Jordan and a southern town, in addition to Idlib. Pro-government media have said that Turkish forces jammed Syrian army telecommunication systems in Idlib, contributing to the collapse in defenses. There was no immediate comment from Turkey on Assad's allegations. China's President Xi Jinping visits Pakistan next week, where the two countries are expected to agree on economic and energy deals worth more than $40 billion. Leaders are highlighting how the trip will transform the relationship to focus more on economic development, but it also could have significant implications for security challenges in both countries. VOA's Bill Ide has the story from Beijing.
President Xi Jinping's state visit to Pakistan is the first time a Chinese leader has visited the country in 9 years. Assistant Foreign Minister Liu Jianchao says the fact this is his first foreign trip this year highlights the importance Beijing places on developing Pakistan-China relations. Liu says President Xi's trip will seek to lay out a comprehensive plan for Pakistan-China relations and cooperation over the next 5 to 10 years and take relations to a new level. During the visit, they are expected to sign agreements, many of which are focused on the establishment of a mega project the two are calling the Pakistan-China Economic Corridor. The corridor seeks to link China's restive and remote western region of Xinjiang with Pakistan's deep water Gwadar port on the Arabian Sea. In addition to the building of railways, roads, and other infrastructure, the two will also sign agreements focused on energy, finance, and science and technology. According to some media reports, the projects could cost as much as $46 billion, a massive amount of money for Pakistan's struggling economy. Since 2009, the United States provided Pakistan with about $5 billion in civilian aid. A spokesman for Pakistan's government says the visit will mark the transformation of relations from a global strategic relationship to a new type of economic relationship between the two countries. But the security side of the relationship is also expected to deepen. China and Pakistan have long enjoyed robust security and military ties. Beijing is Pakistan's biggest supplier of military hardware, and just recently reports have revealed plans that Islamabad is seeking to buy 8 submarines from China, a key asset in Islamabad's long-running rivalry with New Delhi. On Beijing's side, authorities are deeply worried about unrest in Xinjiang, which is home to the country's Uyghur Muslim minority group, and has long sought Pakistan's help in addressing the problem. Critics say it is the Chinese government's oppressive restrictions on religious and cultural practices of the Uyghurs that is fueling the violence. But Beijing has linked violent attacks in Xinjiang and other parts of the country to a group believed to have a stronghold in tribal areas along the Pakistan-Afghanistan border. Assistant Foreign Minister Liu Jianchao says Pakistan has been providing China with intelligence and support in its fight against the organization known as the East Turkestan Islamic Movement, or ETIM. The group seeks the independence of Xinjiang, which it calls East Turkestan. He says there are a considerable number of members of the group in Pakistan.
Liu
says the East Turkestan Islamic Movement is an enemy of both states, and we will continue to increase our cooperation to fight terrorists, including those affiliated with the ETIM. Liu adds that combating terrorism is in the interest of both countries. As China and Pakistan push forward with their massive plans for the economic corridor, there are likely to be security challenges. Violent terrorist attacks are a regular occurrence in Pakistan, and the country will reportedly be providing some 12,000 security forces to help protect Chinese workers on the projects. Addressing Pakistan's security problems is part of Beijing's motivation for promoting the project, says Hu Tiangbun, an assistant professor with the China program at the S. Rajaratnam School of International Studies in Singapore.
The idea is that they want to boost the economic development of Pakistan, and if Pakistan's economy develops, and you know, then it would help reduce the problem of terrorism.
Hu says that while that is the broad logic and intent of the plan, what is less certain is whether the plan will be successful. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
Police in Indian Kashmir say they've arrested an influential separatist leader for helping organize the march calling for Pakistani control of the Himalayan region. Indian officials say Masarat Alam was arrested Friday at his home under the country's Unlawful Activities Act. It prohibits any events that challenge the sovereignty of the Indian state. Alam Wednesday helped lead an anti-India protest during which demonstrators waved Pakistani flags and chanted pro-Pakistan slogans. The peaceful protest was widely condemned by Indian politicians. Italian police have arrested 15 African Muslims suspected of throwing 12 Christians to their death from a migrant boat in the Mediterranean Sea. Police in Sicily's capital of Palermo said they were arrested on charges of multiple homicide motivated by religious hatred. Those arrested were from Ivory Coast, Mali, and Senegal. Survivors reported the assailants had thrown 12 people from Nigeria and Ghana into the sea and threatened other Christians. Thanks for being with us today for International Edition. Get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Ira Melman.